As Ukrainians take to the streets in numbers not seen since the Orange Revolution, the Russian opposition is looking on in awe, and also with more than a bit of trepidation. Coming almost exactly 2 years after mass protests rocked Moscow, some see Ukraine's Euromaidan uprising as a lesson, an inspiration, and a precedent for Russia. But with Vladimir Putin saying the events in Kyiv resemble, quote, a pogrom, others fear that the Ukrainian uprising could lead to the Kremlin tightening the screws in order to prevent any contagion. They used to say that if Moscow sneezed, then Kyiv caught a cold. But today, that cliche is being turned on its head. Hello from our studios in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me via Skype is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And also on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, all.
And also joining us via the magic of Skype and also from New York City is special guest Nina Khrushcheva, a professor of international affairs at the New School, director of the Russia program at the World Policy Institute, whose latest book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, will be out next spring. Welcome back, Nina.
Thank you.
In an open letter, a group of Russian writers and poets wished the Kyiv protesters success, adding, quote, "This would be a sign that in Russia, we too can defend our rights and freedoms. We are with you." Likewise, opposition figure Boris Nemtsov said that by supporting the demonstrators in the Maidan, quote, "we are supporting ourselves." At the same time, many Russian westernizers are concerned that the success of the Ukrainian protests could lead to a crackdown against them. Journalist Yuri Saprykin wrote on Facebook, quote, "I am very sympathetic to our Kyiv friends, but at the same time, it's clear that if the Euromaidan is victorious, then the worries that Russia will turn into a complete hellhole will be accepted as a medical fact. If, as a result of the previous Ukrainian revolution, we got the Nashi movement and sovereign democracy, and as a result of the Arab Spring, we got Putin's third term, then I don't even want to think about the hypothetical ramifications of the current victory." So we got inspiration on one hand and trepidation on the other. Mark, which is it?
I don't think it has to be either or, to be honest.
It never does with you. You like to have your cake and eat it too all the time.
Always. I mean, think about it. I mean, is it going to galvanize the opposition if Euromaidan sort of has some clear positive outcome rather than just... I mean, protests have a certain positive outcome, are positive outcome to an extent, but they ultimately have to lead somewhere. Yes, it certainly could galvanize the Russian opposition, but the big question is whether or not it allows them to reach out beyond their existing base. Again, there is virtue in bringing back, bringing the band back together. You know, the large numbers who originally were willing to protest on Bolotnaya and such like. But if you can't then do something with them, then that's just simply spectacle, nothing more. And we've got to realize, you know, Russia is in a rather different situation. There isn't the prospect of membership of the European Union. There's a different recent experience of politics and so forth. So, yes, I think it would galvanize the opposition, but then we wait and see what they'd actually do with that capital. But at the second time, yeah, of course it's going to galvanize the power vertical. I don't necessarily think we are seeing imminent hellholedom. but nonetheless, you know, I think there's nothing like a good external threat to bring an elite together. An elite that at the moment is, frankly, pretty vociferous, divided, feuding, and uncertain as to which way to go. Ironically enough, who would be the best beneficiary of Euromaidan? It would be the Bastrykins and so forth of this world in that respect, at least in the short term.
Perhaps. Another thing that I was, as I was preparing this, I was thinking about is this isn't 2004. Now, when the Orange Revolution happened, and it did kick off a more harsh turn the screws policy in the Kremlin, but at that time Putin was at the height of his power. This is the end of 2013. This is almost 10 years down the road, 9 years down the road to be exact, and we're looking at a very different political context in Russia. So, Do you think maybe it'll be, if the Kremlin tries to turn up the screws, could that in fact have a obratny rezultat, as they say in Russian, a reverse effect?
It could, but again, I think we need to talk about, well, what are we actually sort of likely to see? This is not going to be some massive crackdown with sort of, thousands of people being arrested or anything like that. Nor, unless the opposition, as it were, push the situation, is it likely to be violence on the streets on any sort of major scale. I think it's more that what we have seen has been an irresolution on the part of the Kremlin in the last couple of years. They sort of, one minute, they're sort of looking to, you know, nail Navalny with ridiculous charges and such like, and then they lose their nerve. Or more moderate, more flexible elements within the elite saying, no, come on, let's, you know, let him stand for election or something like that. We've not really seen any clear line from the Kremlin, or rather we see multiple competing lines. What I'm talking about more is that if there is a sense of a genuine threat, and that's, as it were, two steps down the line, because it depends on, first of all, there being some kind of positive impact for the opposition from Euromaidan, and then secondly, them actually being able to use that productively, which is by no means a given. But if we even assume that, it's not that I think we're suddenly going to get neo-Stalinism redux in Moscow. I think it's just more that those elements within the elite, those strategies that we've already seen being employed, mm-hmm. will actually be employed rather more consistently. Mm-hmm. We're not going to see this quite ridiculous sort of flopping backwards and forwards that we're seeing at the moment.
Nina, how do you see it? You just got back from Moscow. How do you see this resonating in Russia? And do you see any possibility for contagion or for the opposite, for the Kremlin, give the Kremlin the excuse to crack down?
Well, I completely agree with Mark that threat from the outside, from abroad, could actually cement the elites more than they are today. On the other hand, it actually can fragment them more, because there's certainly elements within those elites that are looking at the West and looking at Putin as a much more and more increasingly ridiculous figure that may not be beneficial for the future of Russia as is. And so that could also fragment those on top. Perhaps Stalinism is not going to come immediately, and maybe not at all. Hopefully Putin will not have enough time to reinstate it. But just my little impression from being in Moscow is that I've never seen so much охрана in my life. And I did grow up in the Soviet Union. So the guards now, I do know that it has been an official sort of state order. Even if you're a private guard, you're supposed to have the same uniform. So they all have same black uniform with some sort of insignia, maybe not necessarily state. And that just the presence of this outside black clad force really makes you very scared. I did feel that at any moment, if I step left, step right, I could in fact end up insulting one of those people, and it may end well, may not end well for me. So in some ways I felt like a person of African-American origin. Sometimes my students say when I'm in Brooklyn or elsewhere, when I see policemen, I don't feel safe. Mm-hmm. For the first time in my life, I felt I was not safe in Moscow, because I was at the mercy, on one hand, of this humongous presence of police, and on the other hand, of this humongous presence of охрана. So my whole gulag of the Russian mind, or gulag of the Russian physical presence, actually made me feel quite scared. And I don't know, I'm sure it's much more psychological pressure than anything else. But as we know in Russia, from psychology to physicality, it's just one step.
Mm. Kirill, what do you think? Can we see some contagion here?
First of all, several words about охрана and a lot of people, you know, in this security uniform. It's a very economic thing, because that's how they struggle with unemployment in Russia. There are several millions, I'm not joking, there are several millions of such people in the, you know, private security, you know, staff and so on in Russia. So there are several economic strategies how to fight with unemployment, and I think Russia invented, as usual, you know, its own special way. I love the word which had been used by Mark, to galvanize. you know, scientists in the 19th century, they used to galvanize, you know, dead bodies of animals and people and so on. And I'm, you know, I'm not sure
I like where you're going here, but go ahead.
I'm not speaking that, you know, Russian opposition or even Power Vertical are dead or dead bodies, but something interesting about the usage of this very word is still. Because, speaking seriously, I think that the main problem of Russian opposition, that's the problem why it's not, you know, it's not alive in the whole, you know, meaning of this word, is that it's lack its own agenda, political, serious, political, pragmatic agenda. And that is the thing which, you know, Ukrainian opposition has. Mm-hmm. That is the great difference. It's a very ridiculous, you quoted a very ridiculous, you know, words by Yuri Saprykin that, you know, whatever is happening in the world, in the big world, is very bad for Russian opposition. Yeah, revolution in Ukraine is very bad. You know, Arab Spring is extremely bad and so on. So what does it mean? It means that in some sense, in philosophical terms, a Russian opposition is reactionary. It's not reactionary in political terms, yes, but it's all about the reactions on the actions mm-hmm. of, you know, the authorities, the, you know, various events in Ukraine and so on. It doesn't have its own political agenda. And when we look at, I don't know what is behind these protests in, by the way, in Ukraine. I'm not specialist in Ukrainian politics and so on, but I can you know, suppose that there are several very serious interests behind these protests. Yes, there are several, you know, very powerful groups behind this, you know, protests, which are,
yeah,
you know,
I think,
unhappy.
I think that's a fair assessment because a lot of the oligarchs wanted to go to the European Union.
Absolutely. That's why I'm speaking that there is a very serious political agenda in all these Ukrainian protests. And that is, which is absolutely absent when we speak about Russian opposition. Russian opposition is all about speaking, you know, look at this Ukrainian events. So we must do the same, or we mustn't do the same, or we must do something in the connection of this and this and this and that. So I think the main problem is that Russian opposition, Russian liberals, they cannot speak about, you know, say Ukrainian events as Ukrainian events themselves, without any connection to their own interests, wishes, imagination, and so on. And the second point, that Russian opposition cannot speak about its own interests without any connections to the, you know, Ukraine, Georgia, you know, Syria, and so on. They cannot speak in the terms which are focused on the internal problems of Russia.
One of the problems I had with Yuri Saprykin's assessment, and he is correct, after the Orange Revolution, we got all of these anti-Orange phenomena, all these anti-Orange tactics that the Kremlin was starting to use to prevent anything like this happening in Russia. He's right. And after the Arab Spring, yeah, that may have had an effect, I'm not sure, in the decision to bring Putin back or not. Maybe, we don't know. We don't know what's in the minds of the... But what bothered me the most about this quote was that it all assumed that Russian society was a completely passive actor. The reactions to the Orange Revolution was possible because society let the Kremlin take these measures. Society was very passive at the time. And again, we're looking at a very different societal context. So the Saprykin's comments basically assume a very passive Russian society. And I wonder, again, if the society might not be more proactive. I'm not sure that it's the opposition is as dead as Kirill thinks it is. But one of the things that did strike me in all this was that we have a very similar phenomena in Ukraine and Russia. If you say Russia 2011 and Ukraine now, playing out in very, very different contexts. In both cases, we have a post-Soviet generation that's this weird cocktail, or maybe not so weird cocktail, of pro-Western liberalism and nationalism, right? in both cases, you have a tough guy opposition leader that's trying to ride the wave. Vitaly Klitschko in the Ukrainian case, and of course Alexei Navalny in the Russian case. And God, it would be very interesting if both of those two gentlemen turned out to be the presidents of their respective countries. It would be very interesting meetings between the two of those. But we also have some very key differences. In Ukraine, as Mark pointed out, the draw of Europe is very, very real. It is not out of the realm of reasonable speculation that Ukraine could someday be a member of the European Union, and the potential of signing of an association agreement was the first step in that. This is absent in Russia. Let's face it. Russia is not going to be a member of the European Union. Right? It's just not going to happen. Another key difference, Ukrainian politics from the very beginning has been more competitive. Think about it. There's been four Ukrainian presidents, two incumbents have lost, and one has designated successor lost. You had Leonid Kravchuk losing an election to Leonid Kuchma. Kuchma won re-election. His designated successor, Yanukovych, lost to Yushchenko in 2004. And then Yushchenko lost to Yanukovych. So you have an actually already more competitive political context. And thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, the Ukrainians don't seem to have the fear that the Russians have. Ukrainians aren't afraid to go out in the streets. Boris Nemtsov pointed out in an interview with our Russian service this past week that if you look at how many people were on the Maidan last week, and the estimates run between 400,000 and 800,000, that's more than we got on the streets back in 2011, in December 2011, January 2012, on Bolotna and on Prospect Sokotov. So the Ukrainians are less afraid to protest. They never had an experience like the events of 1993 in Russia, where things turned that bloody. So it's coming out to protest is just natural for them, and it's easier to get more people on the streets. But I wanted all of you to kind of to weigh in on this, the differences between Ukraine and Russia in this regard. Nina, you have a very unique perspective on this, I would imagine. Why don't you go first?
Well, actually, I think you're absolutely right. These are two different countries, although, of course, Russians always say that we are the same nation. Well, we are not the same nation, although we are both Slavs. I think the beginning of it was very similar, December 2011 in Bolotna and now Maidan, because as you remember, in December, protests in Moscow started with Putin and Medvedev basically decided how they're going to divide power between themselves and just imposed it on the nation. And really, the expectation was different that Putin is not going to run for his third term, but the way it was presented, just matter of factly, with an absolute disdain for the public opinion. The same thing was here, President Yanukovych was playing both sides and saying and just talking about European integration just a few days before the summit in Vilnius, and suddenly decided to turn 360 and just not go that direction altogether. It's just the matter of fact, this disrespect for the public, I think, brought people to the streets in both cases. But then I think it is exactly what you're saying, is that first of all, European integration was a possibility, which is not the case in Russia. But generally, I completely agree with Kirill. I'm sorry to say that my people are much more complacent than the Ukrainian people generally. They are very reflective of what's happening outside. Russia is so big, it is basically obsessed with Russia. It can afford just being concentrated on Russia as the most important part of the Eurasian space. Not so for Ukraine. Ukraine actually has to make allegiances and alliances and take care of itself in relations to other nations, which often Russia doesn't believe it has to.
Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to start just by sort of taking issue with the notion that the difference in numbers of protesters is primarily because of fear. In the sense of, you know, I really don't get the sense that most Russians were sitting there thinking, gosh, I really want to be there on Bolotnaya, but I was afraid of what the Amonovtsi were going to do.
But remember a little scandal with Nemtsov before where he was caught on that wiretap saying, how am I going to get these frightened little hamsters on the street?
Obviously, everything that Nemtsov says we should regard as an objective fact.
There were genuine, I don't think everything Nemtsov says is an objective fact, but I think what Nemtsov said prior to the first big Bolotnaya protest was there were concerns that they weren't going to be able to get people out on the streets beyond your professional protesters to get, because the whole key was getting ordinary people out there, and that had not happened before that.
No, that's true, but I still think that it's one of the convenient excuses that is sometimes used by the opposition leaders, that basically it's that the little people are just too scared, rather than actually thinking that for many of them, A, they may just not have the optimism of spirit to think that the protest actually could do anything. B, they may not actually believe in the particular sort of views that are going to be espoused at the protest. Because if we think about 1993, apart from the fact that that's ancient history, that was essentially an intra-elite conflict. That was not a sort of suppression of a mass rising or anything like that. So, I just think we have to be cautious there.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, let me go back. I think you said you made a really important point when you talked about Ukraine as having competitive politics, as being something that is something that is absolutely substantively different from Russia. But I think it's not just a question of the fact that there are elections and sometimes people lose elections and sometimes they win them, though that is obviously very important. I think it's also the extent to which Ukraine has gone rather further in the differentiation of different forms of elite power. That, for example, you have the sort of, as it were, the state elite around Yanukovych, who are clearly the ones who are going to benefit, or rather not lose, by cancelling the agreement with the European Union. And that's what it came down to. And then you had these economic oligarchs who at one point were perfectly happy to support Yanukovych for political reasons, but on the other hand, actually don't like what he's done over the European Union. And even, you've got people, never mind the Akhmetovs and so forth, someone like Dmytro Firtash, who's, Mr. Gas. And you think if anyone was going to see key reasons to be in tight with Moscow, it will be someone involved in the gas industry. But even he, we're seeing his TV stations, actually providing rather more airtime to the protesters than one might have thought. And so a final point I make, in terms of, you have this kind of, I think, much more different forms of competitive power within Ukraine. But again, I don't think I'd want to exclude that. Let me just go back. You can't expect me not to talk about the Okhranniki.
Of course not.
If that's been raised, it's impossible for me. And I accept I'm a freak. I am happiest swimming through a sea of uniformed thugs. But nonetheless, if we look at this massive expansion in Okhrana, and yes, they're all wearing the same uniform, and therefore that creates this sense of monolithic power. But even, and here I really ought to throw in a sort of a Middle-earth reference to the orcs of Sauron and Saruman squabbling, but I won't.
Don't get Kirill going.
What it in part represents is actually a fragmentation of coercive power, even in Russia. Even in Russia, these Okhranniki may not be particularly well-trained, they may not be well-armed and so forth, but they represent an erosion in the monolithic power of the state that is part of, I think, of its historical development. That actually, Putin and all, all the Tsar's horses and all the Tsar's men can't put that particular Humpty Dumpty back together again. So, I think, Ukraine is further down the line of the fragmentation of coercive economic and political power than Russia is. But nonetheless, I think this kind of, Russia's historical trend is heading that way. So it's not, as it were, that I think what happens in Ukraine today is going to affect Russia tomorrow. But in some ways, Ukraine does offer a window, or a crystal ball, let's say, whereby the Russian elite can look at their future.
Kirill, would you agree with that? Is we have a case where Ukraine is leading Russia?
It's not leading, it's different. I think the main, as I already told, the main mistake of Russian, even the position Russian liberals, that they're speaking about Ukraine in their own terms. I agree with Mark. Political system and political landscape in Ukraine is not divided but diversified. It's not a division, it's a diversity. And I think, I'm not a specialist in Ukrainian history and, you know, recent state of politics and so on, but I can suppose that the reason is that the very country, Ukraine, is on the brink of division between, you know, so-called Eastern Ukraine, so-called Central Ukraine, Ukrainian Ukraine itself, and Western Ukraine. And in this situation, all the politics, all, you know, the actors on this political and economic scene and so on, they must be very cautious about the division. Must be very, very, very cautious. Another situation is in Russia. Russia, with the, you know, some problems, serious problems with Caucasus and so on, is a quite, you know, monolithic state. That's why opposition and authority, they can play the real gap, a real division between them. I think that is a very important point. That is the very, very important point about the difference of the situations in Russia and Ukraine. And my another point is it's about Russian attitude to Ukraine itself. Even so, I read a lot of you know, columns, essays, articles written by Russian liberals about the situation in Ukraine, you know, for last 2-3 weeks, and it's very interesting that no one wrote about Ukraine as a, you know, it's a different thing, as about, you know, different state, about different society, without any, you know, serious connection to Russia. Moreover, in almost all the these texts, I can read, you know, still the same arrogance and still this, you know, post-colonial attitude to Ukrainian society.
Are you speaking of Arkady Babchenko's piece in Sloan, for example?
No. So I don't want to name the particular authors and so on, but my impression, yes, it's absolutely the same.
One of the more clever pieces I read was the blog post by Arkady Babchenko that was on Sloan, where it was written very sarcastically. Even the headline was, you know, Ukrainian brothers. It was like, you know, please do everything we did so 2 years down the road you can be where we are. So, and it was a very sarcastically, very cleverly written piece. But I think along these lines, I think Masha Gessen, the author and journalist, Moscow-based author and journalist who blogs at the New York Times, hit this on the head with a piece that said what the Russian opposition is feeling is white envy, basically. White envy as opposed to black envy. Why can't we do this? And this is where contagion comes into effect. This is where inspiration comes into effect. And this is where it can become very real. Despite the big differences that we've outlined between these two countries, I think the Kremlin is not right, but well, right from its perspective, to be a little worried about this, actually. But there's another reason why the Kremlin is obviously worried. And I wanted to go to Mark with this because it's a point you made on the last podcast. And I wanted you to expand on it a little bit, because this isn't just about emotion and about Russia's cultural ties to Ukraine. It isn't just about fear of contagion. There are very, very serious material interests at stake here. As I wrote in the blog this week, one key part of the Putin model is this effort to quote unquote capture elites by using this corrupt system, which uses the carrot of corruption and the stick of compromise. And this is used very effectively inside of Russia to keep the elite compliant. Well, Putin's trying to expand that to the whole Eurasian space, and Ukraine occupies a very important part of that economic space. Mark, last week you made a very salient point along these lines about how central Ukraine is to this. I used that quote on my last blog post. I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit more. I mean, how central is Ukraine to as a money laundering hub or for the not so open parts of the Russian economy, as you put it?
Yeah, it's interesting the extent to which that's the one great success story of the Russian economy and its relationship with Ukraine. You know, despite all kinds of other attempts to sort of to build interconnectivities on, you know, joint construction of aircraft and so forth, it seems to be only the crooks who actually know how to do this properly. It's always the way. I think it is very clear that just as without Ukraine, Russia's claims to being able to create some pan-Eurasian customs or other unions look thoroughly threadbare. Well, so too, without Ukraine, Russia begins to have trouble in terms of managing the shadowy side of its economy, which stretches the full range from the totally and completely criminal, you know, the laundering of drug proceeds from Afghan heroin and such like, all the way through to the sort of criminal but more sort of shadowy, evading tax, moving money, obscuring the ultimate beneficiary of various investments in Europe and beyond and so forth, through to actually what is just simply a sort of a part of just the natural management and flow of a lot of sort of Russian businesses. Because I mean, I think what Ukraine represents is precisely a turntable. Just as we've seen, for example, we still see arms shipments going through the port of Odessa, and sometimes sort of then sort of skipping into the Transnistrian "quote unquote" republic, for then sort of further transfer to parts God knows where, and so too we see a lot of money now. You know, it's not that Ukraine is the kind of financial jurisdiction that if money comes from Ukraine, people assume that it's as clean as can be. But on the other hand, it represents one more firebreak in sort of the global ways of avoiding anti-money laundering controls. So maybe you bounce your money from Ukraine to Cyprus, to Latvia, and thence to the more prestigious but also more sort of diligent jurisdictions and so forth, rather than moving it straight out of Moscow. Because we know that for all kinds of reasons, money coming out of Moscow often raises red flags. Mm-hmm. And I think in particular, we're seeing this in the context of the fact that there is now on a variety of fronts what we might think of as a global pushback against the up to now unfettered flow of Russian money.
Yeah, they lost Latvia.
Well, they may be losing Latvia. Okay, okay. I mean, give them their due, but there's still a long way to go, and indeed Cyprus. But we've seen it in the context of Magnitsky, that sense that officials now actually sort of need to worry about where their money comes from. We've seen it in the context of the U.S. Treasury's attempt to name a whole variety of criminal-related kingpins and freeze their assets. We see it in a whole variety, and it's not just Americans. I mean, in a whole variety of different ways. After about 20 years of being given a free pass, now all of a sudden Russians are starting to find themselves having to account for where their money comes from. And one of the ways in which they're responding to that is precisely is by using Ukraine as a sort of a middle-ranking sort of transfer point. Mm. If they lose that, and they would lose that if actually Ukraine is forced to comply with European Union constraints. This is exactly why they're losing Latvia. Well, all of a sudden, they'd have to start looking elsewhere. And they're running out of reputable places to go. You know, you can't really then say, well, I don't know, we'll just rely on Nauru and Uzbekistan. You need places that look legitimate, that have a high level of existing trade, a strong financial infrastructure and so forth. Without those, that actually begins to impact on people's pocketbooks in a way that grand political issues of which way Ukraine flows maybe don't.
So losing Ukraine, if I could really summarize it all in a nutshell, might actually be very good for Russia in the long run, because it will force the economy to be more transparent, but it would be very bad for Putin and his inner circle. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's one of these issues that unite the Russian elite in a way that a lot of other issues don't.
And another reason why maybe they're not thinking about it in these terms, but that the Russian opposition, if their aim is truly a more transparent and open society, that they would be supportive of the Ukrainian opposition and Ukraine moving to Europe.
One would hope so.
Well, on that note, we'll move to the second half. In a few moments, we'll shift gears and take a look at the upcoming amnesty that Putin will announce on the occasion of the Russian Constitution's 20th anniversary. Who, if any, of Russia's political prisoners will be freed? I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me via Skype from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Also joining us on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via the magic of Skype and also from New York City is special guest Nina Khrushcheva, a professor of international affairs at the New School and director of the Russia program at the World Policy Institute, whose latest book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, will be out next spring. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
This amnesty can only apply to individuals who did not commit grave crimes or crimes involving violence against representatives of the authorities. By this I mean law enforcement officers. I agree with you that such actions should bring about reconciliation and should underscore the humanism of our state.
When the Kremlin announces a massive prison amnesty this month to mark the 20th anniversary of the Russian Constitution, it could free tens of thousands of inmates. Most of them we've never heard of. But this week, there were rumors, rumblings, and leaks that there might be some famous names among them. Putin's human rights advisor, Mikhail Fedotov, told reporters this week that jailed former oil executive Mikhail Khodorkovsky, as well as Pussy Riot members Nadezhda Tolokonnikova and Maria Alokhina, could be among those amnestied. Putin this week ruled out amnesties for the dozens of defendants in the so-called Bolotnaya case against those charged after anti-Kremlin protests in May 2012 turned violent. And the president's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said naming any of those, including Khodorkovsky and the Pussy Riot defendants, would be, quote, premature. Kirill, as always, we have mixed signals here. No way on the Bolotnaya prisoners, and looks like a maybe on Khodorkovsky, Tolokonnikova, and Alokhina, all of which are due to be out next year anyway, although there's always new charges brewing against Khodorkovsky. Tolokonnikova and Alokhina are due out in March. What are you expecting to happen? I mean, the big thing is Khodorkovsky. That would be a big symbolic act. Is this just, the Achirednoy, fake rumors coming out, or is there something real cooking here, do you think?
I think definitely not Khodorkovsky, definitely. First of all, we just, heard about a new so-called new case. It's not a new, actually, new case against Khodorkovsky involving laundering of $10 billion. And, of course, this information was, just focused on the very perspectives of Khodorkovsky being, amnestied. I'm not sure about Tolokonnikova and Alokhina, but possibly, maybe. They could be freed because, just a few months them to
be in
prison.
They only have a few months left in their sentences anyway.
Yes, and that could happen, as a bright side of this amnesty. So Khodorkovsky, of course, will be excluded from this list, but Alokhina and Tolokonnikova could be included in it. But what's interesting is that all the situation about Khodorkovsky, I remember all these rumors about that Khodorkovsky could be freed several years ago, and it was another amnesty, not such big scale and so on. And everyone told that no, of course Putin would not free him because he wants him to be freed just exactly in 2014 when there will not be, any challenges to Putin's power and so on. And that's why Khodorkovsky, when he will be freed, he will not be, dangerous for the regime. Mm-hmm. And what do we see now? Situation is not safe for Putin.
Mm-hmm.
In 2013, and we can suppose that it will not be absolutely safe for him in 2014. That means that all this strategy of consolidation of the regime, all this strategy of constructing of the safe situation for Putin and his circle in the nearest future, it failed. Situation is still shaky. And that the very fact that Khodorkovsky will not be freed during this amnesty, which could be a great PR positive act from the from Putin himself and so on, that means that situation is quite shaky for the regime. And I think that's important. That's the most important thing in this in this question.
Nina, what are your expectations here?
Well, I mean, I just was reading Khodorkovsky's lawyer's announcements that Khodorkovsky himself obviously doesn't believe that he will be amnestied because, as Kirill pointed out, Putin has no reason to do that. And, of course, that would have been a great PR coup for the Kremlin, but it would have been a great PR coup for the Kremlin in 2008 when Dmitry Medvedev came as president and could have done it to sort of cement his modernistic, so to speak, or civilizing agenda, as he used to call it. So I don't really expect Khodorkovsky to be freed. On the other hand, it's only 1 year left towards the end of his sentence. This sentence that could happen. And another thing is just the deputy state prosecutor just spoke about Khodorkovsky's release and said, well, it's not political. Of course, you also heard Dmitry Medvedev speaking to the press just recently saying Russia does not have political prisoners. They're all there for the reasons. I mean, clearly we have no political prisoners. And so Khodorkovsky, as deputy prosecutor stated, had real crimes behind him. He was a thief. And therefore, as the prosecutor pointed out, make your own conclusions. So that suggests that there's no Khodorkovsky freedom to come up. On the other hand, we may be surprised. As for the Pussy Riot story, I think that is also possible, as Kirill says, it is possible they would be released. On the other hand, once again, I read very carefully Medvedev's address to the press, and Medvedev did say that hooliganism is not something that we are going to amnesty people for, because we have to be aware of what kind of actions, when they're released, they are going to pursue, which to me reads between the lines, because the women were accused of or charged with hooliganism. And they are not going to give up their Pussy Rioting act. So I don't really see how the state is going to justify their release. So I am actually very big pessimist on that, because I don't think Kremlin is smart enough to give itself a PR boost, but it's always stupid enough to continue with further oppression, thinking that it works for it.
The thing that made me suddenly take this seriously, because I didn't take it seriously until I saw this, is, and maybe I shouldn't have, maybe I overreacted to this, but Bloomberg had a piece on the market reaction, how the market seemed to be kind of expecting, or maybe not expecting, but showing signs that it might be expecting something along these lines. But you both mentioned this, both Mark and Kirill and Nina mentioned this idea of a PR boost. I'm going to be kind of counterintuitive and go to you, Mark. Wouldn't it be a brilliant stroke by the Kremlin to let Khodorkovsky out, and right at this moment when they're feeling vulnerable, that might kind of appease the situation a little bit as the events are going on in Ukraine, to return to what we were talking about in the first half?
I think it would be brilliant and daring. However, I don't think we've actually seen the Kremlin being either brilliant or daring. So in this respect, I'm absolutely sort of in agreement with Nina and Kirill, that I think with Khodorkovsky, I think it's very little likelihood that he's going to be let free. I'm slightly more optimistic about Pussy Riot on the principle that, even when they're Pussy Rioting, then they are a relative pinprick. If they're allowed out, amnestied on their own recognizance, and they actually say, yes, of course, I'll sign a piece of paper saying I'm not going to commit more crimes, and then they go out and do the same thing, it allows the state to say, look, what else could we do? We bent over backwards. They committed this blasphemous hooliganism. Then we still let them out of prison early when they promised not to do it again, and yet they didn't. That might be a sort of a minimalist PR thing. But I think I just want to make one point, which is, you mentioned that we've never heard of the overwhelming majority of the people who are likely to be set free because of this amnesty. I think it's just worth dwelling just for a moment on said unknown people. A large number of them are basically business people. who are, you know, in there for low-level economic offences, in many cases entirely spurious ones that are there just simply because it's one of the ways in which actually corrupt law enforcers extort money out of business people, and in other cases because, as it were, they were found guilty of doing the same things that probably almost all their colleagues are doing. An amnesty that lets out, you know, a fair number of these people is not only part of I have to give them credit, a genuine shrinkage of the prison population within Russia, faster than the actual shrinkage of the population. And secondly, it's a way of consolidating the Kremlin's grip on that kind of lower level of the economic elite, not the oligarchs or even the mini-garchs, but the wannabe-garchs, the people who otherwise actually are part of the logical sort of constituency of the Navalny's of this world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because that's what we've seen. It's actually a lot of these people who are sort of there who are saying, the police are coming and hassling me. I can't set up my business because I fear raiding or whatever. So in that respect, although, it wouldn't hit the big headline-grabbing sort of stories, particularly the Khodorkovsky case. But nonetheless, I think this amnesty does have a distinct political and economic dimension behind it.
Before we wrap up, there's another thing I wanted to touch on about this amnesty, and that is, can they? I mean, there's been a lot. There's been a lot written about this in the Russian press. It is coming on the 20th anniversary of the Russian Constitution, which will be on the 12th of December next week. Since they've made such a big hoopla about this, can they do this without having some headline-grabbing name in the mix? Or is the amnesty itself enough to achieve the desired effect of it?
I'd say they can.
They can?
I think they can, absolutely. It's just the amnesty itself is sort of talking about Putin. Puny PR is that suggests that, well, look at me, I'm forgiving of my enemies. We celebrate the Constitution because he needs to tout his devotion to democratic process. I mean, it's slightly ironic because there have been calls in Moscow, a lot of calls in Moscow to amend this constitution, this free constitution, and attach some sort of religious clause to it, saying that, offending the feelings of the faithful is so horrible. So it would be quite interesting if the Pussy Riot members would be released and then the constitution would get amended with a religious clause. But nonetheless, I completely agree with Mark. The whole amnesty idea really has very big historical significance in Russia. And every time when the government does amnesty, the government is perceived as some sort of a liberal institution to a degree.
Kirill, what about that? As we head towards the end, I mean, why is this idea of an amnesty why does it have such resonance in Russia? I mean, in Western countries, presidents have pardon power, and they periodically pardon people. Often, U.S. presidents do a lot of them towards the end of their final term, but we don't have this concept of a mass broad amnesty. It's kind of alien to a lot of Westerners. What is the attraction of this in the Russian context?
I think historically and still recently, it bears the very idea of, huge amnesty bears a sign of ideological event. Because don't remember that all these amnesties before the revolution, they were, all about the sum of celebrations of, 300 years of Romanov House dynasty and something like this. So we won the war against something, and so that's why we are doing this. During Soviet times, amnesties were all about, the anniversaries of October Revolution and something like this. And that was a great ideological meaning, that now we free, tens of thousands of people from the prisons because our ideology is absolutely right, and because October Revolution, happened in 1917, so something like this. Now I see also a sort of ideological meaning, but not in the very fact of the of this amnesty, but in the way how Kremlin is handling the issue. Because if, as we, you know, a lot of times we spoke about this, if a latest, you know, ideological trend by Kremlin is that is a so-called, you know, people's power, you know, Ural Vagon Mash, that's why we will free a lot of ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
Not Khodorkovsky, not all these, you know, girls from Pussy Riot and so on, who are, you know, who are icons of Western influence and so on, liberals and so on. No, we are on the side of so-called ordinary people. That's why we're handling this amnesty this way. I think the signal will be this, of this sort of, you know... Yes.
Well, we'll certainly find out this week. Last word, Nina, very quickly.
I just want to say it also proves that it's still the Tsar system because it's not a legal system, it's not a democratic system. The Tsar forgives, and that's what that message is.
No, that's a very good point. I'm glad you raised that. And that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me via Skype from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Also joining us on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia Security Services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via the magic of Skype and also from New York City has been special guest Nina Khrushcheva, a professor of international affairs at the New School, director of the Russian program at the World Policy Institute, whose latest book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, will be out next spring. Thanks to all, as always, for an enlightening discussion.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliantly patient and patiently brilliant producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the totally cool Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.